Well, that means it's PhD at Rice University in Houston. And he's going to tell us about quantum critical dynamics and quantum mechanics.
Okay. Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank, thanks for your invitation, and thanks for the very helpful discussion with Logia, Sanji, and Kipri. So actually, the environment here is very nice. I'm very impressed. Quantum is favors a lot of literature, and now the cold weather outside, I think, also welcomes my story today. It's a quantum story. So my name is Jian Dawu from UC San Diego. Today, I'm going to talk about quantum critical dynamics in quantum mechanics. At the very beginning, I would like to thank the collaborators over the past few years, Qi Miao Si from Rice University, Qi Miao Si is my PhD advisor, Yong De Zhang from USTC is my advisor when I was in USTC, and Li Jun Zhu now is at UC Riverside. And these two Andes are from UK, and they are two very good and very excellent experimentalist. And Sergei Belov is a mathematician at the University of Houston. I learned a lot of analytical techniques from this guy, especially the Riemann-Hilbert problem. Martin Kommers now is in Hungary. He is a master in form factor. I learned a lot of stuff about form factor from him for carrying out the ES story. Elihu Abrahams from UC Los Angeles. And Tony Wu is my postdoc supervisor from UC San Diego. And Fei Zhou is from University of British Columbia. And Mason Zhao is my earlier collaborator at USTC. Unfortunately, he is now out of physical community, and now he is in a commercial company working on the quantum information industry in Jinan, China. And Zhou Wang is also a very good experimentalist in Germany and from University of Augsburg. And we have a very good collaboration on the story of the XXZ project. Wang Yang and Sun Longxi are two very good students of Chong Jin Wu. R.R. Pawani from now is at Singapore. Unfortunately, he's also outside the physics community. But I actually learned a lot of field theoretical techniques from this guy. He's very smart. And Jed Pixley, he's a master of quantum Monte Carlo. Now he's in UMD. It's University of Maryland. Okay, this is an outline of my today's talk. Basically, it's divided into four parts. The first part will be an introduction. In the introduction, I will give a brief introduction about what is quantum criticality, why it is important, and why it is difficult. And then we will move to two specific stories, and then will be an outlook. First is an introduction. At the beginning, I would like to show you a typical phase diagram, which has a second-order quantum phase transition. And the solid line here is used to illustrate a second-order classical phase transition. And this phase transition is surprised by this non-thermal tuning parameter. In condensed matter system, it could be magnetic field, doping, pressure, and something like that. And then this transition temperature can be surprised to a zero temperature to this point. And this point is called as a quantum critical point, where the quantum phase transition happens from a disorder to order region, as illustrated here. So well, various of dashed line here, broken dashed line here, are used to illustrate the crossover region, which usually are characterized by the characteristic energy scale of the system and compare with the characteristic energy scale of the system with the temperature. And in this region, usually the characteristic energy scale of the system is much larger than the temperature. Then usually the wave function here show us a short range style. However, well, what is the more interesting region is in this region. In this region, the temperature scale, the energy scale of temperature will be much larger than the characteristic scale of this of the systems. And then there will be a very fierce competition between the quantum fluctuation and small fluctuation. This very fierce competition between these two fluctuations are generally believed to be responsible for many emergent unconventional phenomena in many different kinds of materials, from quasi 2D, quasi 1D, and to to this three-dimensional material. And this is a high wafer material, and this is a superconductor, and this is a very long-studied Stoney Lucenate 327 material. And this is a quasi one-dimensional of carbon niobium, which realized the EA dynamic excitations. So very striking here is that many of although the material is so large and so different, but actually the phase diagram of them show quite similar features. So that makes one reason people believe that studying the properties in this region can give us may have very interesting features hidden inside. And indeed, if we take this as an example, and here for this agonitis as an example, if we use a doping to this value about 0.3, we can observe that the TC here actually is maximized. Although the quantum clear point here is hidden, is covered by this superconductor dome, that actually also have a strong meaning about studying the phases in this interesting quantum critical region. However, despite of this great interest, describing the dynamics of quantum criticality remains to be a challenge. Except for some special substance in one special dimension, a special situation, none of the analytic, semi-classical, or numerical methods of condensed matter phases can give us an accurate result about dynamic information. So this difficulty is largely due to the far beyond reach, almost infinitely large Hilbert space of the excited state getting involved inside the dynamics. But on the other hand, that may give us strong hints that there must be something new features hidden inside. So over the past few years, trying to understand the general and finite temperature dynamics, especially near quantum critical points, is one of my main focuses over the past few years. And actually, for understanding the dynamic information, here I mainly focus on to understanding the quantity of the two-point dynamic correlation function, because most of our experiments actually is a linear response measurement, and it's largely corresponding to a two-point dynamic correlation function. So a linear response measurement, actually I would like to illustrate the linear response measurement in this form. Usually we can apply a neutron, electron, photon, any kind of particles through the systems. And the particles will carry out certain information because the particle will also weakly interact with the material and will normalize by the material, and then it will pump out, and then we can collect the counting of the density distribution in real time and real space, and then we can get information about the momentum and frequency of the and energy of the systems. So it looks like a bee, right? A bee flying through flowers, and the bee is trying to collect the pollens, and the bee itself is renormalized by the pollens. And then the bee fly away from the flowers, then we can get the information about the flyer by reading the information of the pollens. So this, I think, is very vivid, give us a picture about what is linear response measurements. And the linear response measurement itself can provide us very useful dynamic information in many body systems at both zero and finite temperature. It gives us information not just at a low temperature or low energy, it can also give us information about high frequency. Think about that, it's a real time, right? From zero, T0 to T infinity. So if you do the Fourier transform, actually you can get a full spectrum of information of the system. So linear response measurement is not just give you a low energy phases, it can also give you high energy phases, as we will discuss in our second story today. Now let's move to the first story. It's about a critical marginal dynamics in a model for quantum insulator. Most of my research actually are motivated by experiments. So this project is highly motivated by this very beautiful inelastic neutron scattering measurement on a three-dimensional insulating magnet, tellurium copper chloride 3. This elegant experiment is carried out by Christian Luke's group. The tellurium copper chloride 3 is a three-dimensional insulator. On each side, you have a pair of copers. The two copers strongly bind with each other if there's no external pressure tuning or other magnetic tuning or doping. And then this binding dimers form into a single state. So basically, the ground state of this material is actually as a three-dimensional disorder state. There's no long-range order here. However, their experiment found that upon increasing the pressure to a certain point around 1.07 k bar, a quantum field transition happens, and the system will go inside a long-range anti-Fermi order. So in this experiment, they also can very observe, they can also very clearly observe the Higgs mode, but that's another story. So and then they try to measure the elastic Newton scattering spectrum at the phase temperature and changing the pressure at different point. And they also phase the pressure and increasing the temperature at different point. And at each point, they will have a spectral information of the material. So from a somewhat simplified picture, we can try to understand this material by this simplified model, a J1, J2 model. For each side, there's pairs of copper strongly coupled to each other, and the pressure tuning can be understood as a tool to increase the next nearest neighbor interaction between spins that's different size. So look at this Hamiltonian. If a lambda is zero, apparently each side will be independent with each other. Apparently, it's a disordered state. Each side form into a single ground state. When lambda is equal to one, then it's nothing else but just a three-dimensional anti-ferromagnetic model. And we know the ground state will accommodate a long-range anti-ferromagnetic order. So what happens in between? Then there must be a transition. There must be a transition due to these two different fluctuations. So to a certain point, a quantum phase transition must appear, as is illustrated here, by weakening the binding of the dimers. Until a certain point, the long-range quantum fluctuation will finally break down the dimer and lead into a long-range anti-ferromagnetic order. And then under this picture, then it's very straightforward that we may simplify our understanding a little bit by projecting the model into this singly triply space via bomb operator. And in a mean field picture, the increasing pressure means that we deepen the triplet band. And to a certain point, the triplet band will, why it deepen? Because the increasing pressure will increase the hopping probability of this triplet particle. And it's equivalent to deepen this triplet band. Until a certain point, the triplet band will touch the singleton band and lead into a quantum field transition. So for low energy itself, it's still faithfully reflect the physics in this procedure. So about 20 years ago, Sachdev formulated this low energy theory into a 3+1 O3 invariant quantum field theory. Yeah, we don't know whether it's really work if we study the finite temperature dynamics following this theory, but at this point, we assume this will be our starting point and see what really happened. So this part, this is a motivation from a theoretical part. Actually, a detailed study for the finite temperature dynamics information for this 3+1 5O theory is waiting for exploring. And for the other hand, actually, most of the Newton scattering data in the Lux experiment remains at large. A lot of information remains partial from our theoretical side. We try to understand some of it. So, for understanding the dynamics, it's very tough and challenging.
Just a quick question.
Okay.
Is the spin Hamiltonian side problem free?
I don't know. Because this is a three-dimensional system, I don't think it's easy to simulate by quantum Monte Carlo. And it's dynamics, and it's a finite temperature, and it's dynamics.
Excuse me. In the field theory Hamiltonian, what do I do with alpha and beta then? Can you explain what alpha and beta mean?
Parameter mean?
Alpha and beta?
Sorry, alpha is a component, and tau is the imaginary time.
So there is a sum over alpha?
Yeah, because there's a repeated index here, so it's already sum over, yeah?
Right.
Sorry for the confusion, sorry. Okay, so. So now, because actually it's very tough to really calculate the finite temperature dynamics for a quantum field theory, so we only focus at one region. We only focus at a QCP, and then we turn on temperature, see what really happens for this theory. And actually, when temperature is turned on here, apparently the temperature, the thermal fluctuation will break apart the dimers. It also can cut the long-range anti-ferromagnetic fluctuation. And then they will lead to a very fierce mixture, a very complicated mixture between the thermal degree freedom and a quantum degree of freedom here. So I call this as a quantum Hall soup. So what happens about this quantum Hall soup? So we start from this relativistic d mass 2 epsilon on quantum fiber theory. Here, sure, d is equal to 4, 3 plus 1. So in Lagrangian, we write down here, the mass has been set as 0. Then it's right at the QCP point. And it's renormalizable in principle in the IR limit. Yeah. So but it still contains an infinite series of contour terms. As I say, and right at the QCP with 0, with the vanishing renormalized mass. This is our one RG condition. It does not have a temperature, it does not have a temperature dependent mass. And the contour terms can be determined by the Bratton-Pisarsky resummation program. And here are some basic facts about the BP resummation program. It is a calculation machinery, combines the powerful techniques of epsilon expansion and resummation. The epsilon expansion here takes care about the UV divergences. Resummation here takes care about the IR divergences. And what is more important that it can be carried out systematically order by order, although it becomes more and more involved, more and more complicated. And here, a direct implication following this Bratton-Pisarsky resummation program at the QCP of the theory. After we turn on temperature, we will find that it strictly resides on the QCP. So the mass doesn't move, does not appear. It's still zero. However, it will have a finite thermal mass due to the interaction and the thermal fluctuation, the competition result. So for getting the dynamic information, unfortunately, we have to proceed to two loop. And in a two loop, there's only one diagram which can give us useful dynamic information. That's the so-called sunset diagram. Because only in this diagram, we can fix a finite external momentum and a finite external frequency. So then after we proceed the Lagrangian to this level, after some resum infinite number of diagrams following the resummation procedure, we will get this renormalized two-loop Lagrangian. By using this two-loop Lagrangian, we can carry out a calculation for the self-energy of a sunset diagram, getting the self-energy at a two-loop level. And then once we have a cell energy at two-loop level, at finite temperature, finite momentum, finite frequency, we can pick up the mass information and the damping information here directly, brute forcefully. So here it's still very complicated because here the coupling itself is running. It has a reference energy scale mu zero here, and it has and actually the value of coupling is specifically dependent on the specific energy scale you are looking at. So then the two loop mass is very complicated. So we can observe here, actually this we will already have like something like a T log T shows up here. And we also have a complicated coefficient here. We need to check our paper. And then with this mass and the damping rate at hand, and this mass and damping rate, we only discuss it for the own shear scattering. That means we look at it as at long wavelength limit because that's the region we are caring about. So in this limit, and for this own shear scattering, then the momentum is zero. Then the energy you pump in the system should be equal to the mass. And from here, and then we can solve the self energy and to determine the mass and the damping rate. So now we need to compare how good these results are. We set n equal to 3. However, here now we need an input. Everything here is just a theoretical parameter. So we need to put one data point. The one data point we put here, we would like to choose the mass value, at the maximum temperature as an input here. We choose the maximum temperature as a cutoff, or as a reference energy scale mu zero here. And then we can put the G mu inside here, right at the mu equal to mu zero. And then we can determine G at the mu equal to mu zero. And then we have we have all of coupling respect to that energy scale mu zero. And then we can calculate the mass and damping rate. I don't know if this part here. Okay. So after we finish this calculation, we found that the And then following the second loop, following the exact two loop mice, we can have this running behavior of mice in this form. We can fit this theoretical curve by this function, which is 0.98t plus 0.2t log t. So apparently, in the experiment, they only observe this linear in t behavior. Then what happens about t log t? We can determine the crossover temperature at which the t log t behavior will take over the dominancy of linear in t behavior. So we found that the crossover temperature will be much smaller than the minimum temperature they can reach in experiment. So that's the reason why in experiment they can only observe this linear in t behavior. Actually, this is also a main question in their paper, and then we answer this very nicely. So we actually we also expect that t log t behavior should finally be observed in a certain proper setup of experiments. So now we move to further compare with the damping rate. The damping rate is directly relevant to the so-called four width at half maximum. Think about in every Newton measurement, after you pump through the particle to the material, and then you will get a profile of the Newton distribution with respect to a certain energy. So usually there's a broadness of this profile, and then people can pick up the four width of half maximum of that broadening to describe the damping of the quasi-partial excitations. So it encodes very important dynamic information of resistance. So we did already compare of this damping rate, and then we focus on the linear in T region. We get a theoretical prediction, which is 0.16 T. In experiment, they have very good fitting, which is about 0.15 T. This is very striking. Because in condensed matter systems, there's really very few systems. Most of them actually in 1D can be directly compared with a theory. And however, here we very clearly show that the theory, the underlying low energy effective field theory, can quantitatively agree with the experimental results. It actually is also a very surprising result for us. So, any question so far?
So, what kind of neutron scattering do you
use? In elastic neutron scattering.
I know. I mean, do you use time of light or do you use?
Sorry, I don't know the experimental details actually.
So, basically, I'm asking because usually on top of this intrinsic broadening, there's also a broadening due to the instrument, right? So there's a resolution limit.
But
here it seems that the measured broadening is actually smaller than the theoretical prediction. Usually I would expect the other way around. I would imagine on top of the intrinsic broadening, there's additional broadening due to instruments. So the measure line width should be wider than the intrinsic line.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable question. Yeah, really. But I think in their data, they may have subtracted that information. Have subtracted that background, maybe. And on the other way, the resolution of neutron now actually is very, very, very high resolution now. It's maybe around small. I forgot the magnitude. I discussed with them one time. Maybe smaller than 0.1 millielectron. So it's already have a very good resolution now. Yeah. So any more question?
0.1 millielectron?
Yeah, smaller than 0.1 millielectron. Smaller than that, I think. I remember the value.
I think it depends on what technique you
use. Yeah, depends on what technique you
use. If you use spin echo, you can actually reach millimeter.
Right. But here, I think it also can reach 0.1, smaller than 0.1 millielectron. Yeah. Smaller than 1K, the resolution.
You mean MeV or MeV?
I think milli EV, 0.1 milli EV. Actually, during Hangzhou, this year, when I was in Hangzhou, I discussed with a Newton guy. He said I tried to working on like a micro electron volt resolution limit of neutrons. So that will be very surprising. Then we can push it to even lower energy region to observe what happened about the low energy phases.
Much smaller than 0.05.
Yeah, but I think the resolution resolution actually better than this from their data. I didn't show you the data here. The data is very good actually. Yeah. So here's a part two conclusions I have explained during my talk, during the presentation of this story. So now we move to the second story, which is about the spin dynamics in XSJ chain with an external field. So this is a 1D, one-dimensional XSJ Hamiltonian with an external magnetic field. And the nearest neighbor interaction has been set as 1. And the interaction along z-direction has been reduced by nearest neighbor interaction. And also the magnetic field here also reduced by the nearest neighbor interaction. And the lambda factor for magnetic moments has been absorbed into the magnetic field. So there are a bunch of materials in nature which can be effectively described by this this one-dimensional model. All of them, when you decrease temperature to a certain point, they can effectively describe become a quasi one-dimensional material. I once discussed about 8 months ago when I traveled in China. I discussed with an experimenter about the material. He told me that while the condensed matter experimental is likes to glow the one-dimensional material because that's the easiest and that is very common, and it can be. It can be glowed to a very high purity. So actually one quasi one dimensional material are really very common in from the experimental side. So and then here this is a phase diagram, a zero temperature phase diagram for this 1D Hamiltonian with two parameter data anisotropy and external magnetic field. So it divides into three regions dominated by different physics. So the physics in this gap region and this line is well known, dominated by the spin physics. And the physics in this region from minus 1 to 1, it falls into a so-called XY class. Actually, the low energy phases in this region can be mapped into the well-known Luttinger liquid theory. And the phases in this region is also not hard to understand because when you increase the field to a certain to make the system fully polarized, then or nearly polarized, then apparently the phases in this region will be dominated by magnetic phases. However, there's still a missing part here. What kind of phases will be dominant in this region? So far, it's not known very clear. So for understanding the dominant phases in this region, we still use the 2-point spin-spin correlation to understand its dynamic spectral information. So again, this is still a brute force approach, very brute force. So we directly try to calculate the zero temperature dynamic stress factor of this model by inserting the complete states, the complete many body states here. And this part called as weight. And this weight information is directly proportional to differential cross section in many experiments, in neutron, in ESR, electronic spin resonant, and NMR, and ARPAS, and many different kinds of experiments. So in this talk, I will focus on the transverse dynamic stress factor. We also calculated the longitudinal part, but the details is in our paper. So we figure out the dominant excitations here, as is displayed here. So for the S minus plus, so from our Hamiltonian, we can observe that actually, if it's fully polarized, then all spins will be aligned up. And all spins aligned up will be our reference state. So for the S plus minus, we can see here that then this one will be S plus. That means for S plus, the closed section here or the weight here will be flipped. One spin will be flipped one spin to up direction. And for S plus minus here will be S minus Q here. It will flip one spin to down. So that means if we fix a certain magnetization here, then if flip one spin up, then you are increasing magnetization. And if you flip one spin down, you will decrease the magnetization. And we found that for the S minus plus, the dominant excitation will be so-called pairs of Poissonians. And for S plus minus, the dominance excitations will come from two parts. One part is called so-called Poisson anti-Poisson excitations. And the other part is novel string states with a single two string states or single three string states. And actually, this part of risk state dominance only governed when the magnetization is larger than half fully polarized. And this one will be completely dominant when the magnetization is smaller than the half fully magnetization. And then, so far, then let me give you some feature and some introduction about how to get those classification. So let's start from the coordinate beta answers. Again, the real state here is all strings line up. And from the Hamiltonian, we know that it has a U1 symmetry. So the total spin along J direction is a good quantum number. So we can use the total spin along J direction as a good quantum number to classify all eigenstates in the Hilbert space along the total SJ equal to 0, equal to 1, equal to 2. And now suppose we flip R down spins. And now the total spin along J direction will become N divided by 2 minus R. If you flip one spin down, then you create one magnon. If you flip two spin down, you create two magnon. So then we need to solve the beta answers equation for getting the real wave function. So, and then for this beta answers equation, we need to have an input. The input is the quantum number, so-called beta quantum number. The rules of beta quantum number can become very complicated when we move to the string case. But for the beta quantum number case, we still have some patterns to follow. Like the ground state beta numbers always follow in this way in each sector. So if we flip R down spins, then the beta number is written down in this form from minus R minus 1 divided by 2 until R minus 1 divided by 2. Then we have R beta number quantum number as input, and then we can solve this beta answers equation and get R, and then we can obtain R number rapidities of the renormalized particles, renormalized magnons. And here is the picture for the string state, and it follows the so-called string answers and the beta Gordon Takahashi equations. What's the meaning of string state here? Suppose that we flip a few spins to down direction, and some of them could be combined together and moving together, share a common center. So in this sense, we say there's a string excitation here. It corresponds to a string state. So in string state sense, then the original beta equations should be reduced to this beta Gordon Takahashi equations. Very naively, people might think that now it may be simple because the required number of quantum number will be much less than the real case. Than the previous case. However, it's not true. It's much more complicated. So here I would like to give you some simple picture about those dominant excitations in that region. So let's take the total number of sets n equal to 32 as an example. And suppose now we flip a spin to down direction, from up to down direction. Then first we want to know the ground state. And following the rule I introduced you just now, then we have a number here. The a number runs from minus 7 over 2 until 7 over 2. And then we put these a numbers as input to the beta answers equation. And we'll find that all solutions are real. They distribute on the rapidity plane. And what is the one-pair Poisson state? And then we ship those shaded circles to left one, to right one. And then we dig out two of them, leaving the leftover A numbers as the new quantum numbers as input. And then we can solve this beta answer equation and get a new group of A rapidities of magnons. It corresponds to the excitations in this sector. And then what is the one-pair Poisson anti-Poisson excitation? And it looks like a particle, but however, it's not a real particle. We dig out one hole here and filling a shaded region outside of this range. And then in here, we get another eight quantum number here as a new input, and we can get the eight rapidities of these particles here. And this is called as the one-pair Poisson anti-Poisson excitations. And all of them are real. The solution always are real. And apparently here, the quantum number choice here can overlap with this Poisson anti-Poisson excitations if you ship this shaded region even larger. And then at this situation, you need to exclude the overlap for the real calculation. And then what is the string state excitations? Here is a simple picture. For a single two string state and with a bunch of real state, then that means we combined two shaded regions in the previous one into one. And then we need to face the quantum number here, and the quantum number of string states follows another rule. We have a quantum number here, and then we have a sixth quantum number here. Then we plug in these seven numbers into the BGT equation, and then we can get seven probabilities here. And for a single three string, any question? Okay, sorry. So, and then for a single three string states with a bunch of real solutions, and then we combine the three probabilities here, three quantum numbers into one. And again, there's also another rule for a single string state. We fix a quantum number here. We pick any quantum number here. And then we have still have five quantum number here. We put in this sixth quantum number into this BGT equation. And then we can solve another sixth probability. However, here comes the question. We know we flip eight spins. We should have eight probabilities. Why we only have five or six or seven? And what is the other probability? And this is the string answers. In string answers, it dictates that every string citations must be appear in conjugate with each other. And the imaginary part, and the imaginary part of probabilities can be uniquely determined by the anisotropy parameter data. So basically, we don't need to know the imaginary part. Once we solve a common center, suppose we have three down spins here. They are moving together. Since they are moving together, then sure, their common center will be real, because it describes the real movement of this string. However, it's bounded, asserted by these two imaginary part of another two particle. So basically, the string citation here is a bounded citation, although it's a renormalized of a few number of magnons in this system. So this is the picture for the string states. However, following the beta answers or BGT called BGT answers, it's not helpful for understanding the form factor. And this is the form factor because the real function size will be exponentially increased. So actually, for calculating the form factor exactly, then it will also be exponentially increased with the size. Then it will be impossible for us to know any information about dynamic. It's nothing better than the exact dynamization. And then it comes to after another 40, until 1970s, Fadeev formulated a very beautiful structure, a so-called algebraic beta answers. It starts from this this beautiful Young-Buster equation. Following Young-Buster equation, one can construct a monotomy matrix and in this form. And this ABCD matrix here is very complicated. It is actually a linear composition of all of the spins of the systems. So, and then this monotomy matrix, it can be proved that it still satisfies the Young-Buster algebra. And then what is very nice here is that Fadeev found that every B operator here actually is corresponding to a Magnon creation operator. And the B operator here is a neither boson nor fermion. And then it becomes very simple. You just simply write down the real function by using the creation operator of B in this form. And then for every monotomy matrix, we'll have a so-called transform matrix. For every transform matrix, we have one-to-one correspondence of Hamiltonian. So basically, you will have an infinite number of Hamiltonian in this kind of approach. However, now we only focus our case XIJ model corresponding to so-called sex vortex model. So here, you may ask, do we have advantage even we follow these algebraic beta answers? No, unfortunately. Because the size of each B will be exponentially increased with the size. So again, it has no any advantage compared with the exact dynamization. So the C level of light finally shows up in 1990s after the development of quantum group and the dream field tracer, all of this kind of really fancy stuff in mathematical development. And finally, Mali, Kitanai, and some other colleagues finally found out following this approach by a bunch of complicated mathematical techniques, like called algebra, half algebra, and something like that, and then called cycle, and then they can find out a very nice formalism for this form factor. Finally, it can be shown that the form factor can be formulated in this determinant formula. So all of a sudden, we don't need to worry about the size of the system again. Previously, either the coordinate beta answers or the algebraic answers developed by Fadeev, they have no advantage with respect to the exact annotation. They can only handle the size in the magnitude of order of tens. But now we have determinant formula now. We can handle thousands of size with finite density magnons. We can also handle millions of size with dilute magnons. So with this tool at hand, then we can set up the paradigm to calculate the region we are interested in. We flow a group of beta quantum numbers, plug it into the BGT equation, solve the equation, get rapidities, plug in rapidities into the determinant formula, get the form factors, and plug in into the DSF, Lehmann representation, for getting a dynamic structure factor. And then what is the result? It's very interesting. So we calculate n equal 200. Sure, it can be pushed to 1,000, but it doesn't make too big difference here. And data is set as 2. And then we can show a very clear evolution of the dynamic structure factor here from near J-log magnetization to nearly fully to near full polarization. So here corresponding to the S minus plus, and here corresponding to the S plus minus. So for the S minus plus, that means we flip spin up. All of these plot here are corresponding to the real solution, corresponding to pairs of Poisson excitation. We can see that it becomes less and less important when we increase in magnetization. And then for this lower part, actually corresponding to S minus plus if flip one spin down. Then very interesting that we observe three very clearly separated band structure here. So this part corresponds to the real solution of Poisson anti-Poisson excitations. And this part corresponding to the single two-string excitations. And this part corresponding to the single three-string excitations. And you can see here, it's very dark here. And actually, if we fix one momentum here and draw a line along this here with respect to the energy, you will see a very sharp peak there. That means it's a well-defined quasi-particle, very stable. So what happened about if we turn on temperature? Apparently, this part will still like a quantum Hall soup. However, this part will be stable. They are high energy excitations. So it becomes like a quantum hot porridge or hot quantum hot noodle. That's another maybe question worth to further explore. So one more connection to our conventional understanding for the XG model is this part. They are actually can be approximately described by the Latin liquid theory. So you can see here there are two effective curves here, actually also corresponding to two curves in the Latin liquid theory. But for all of these high energy excitations, they go well beyond the scope of the traditional Latin liquid picture. They represent the new phases here, which is very worth to explore. So sure, if we just have this, it's not enough. People may wonder, are they really feasibly represent almost all physics of the system? Yeah, it's true. We compare the sun rule and the first sun rule. First, we compare the sun rule. For the sun rule, that means that we can exactly determine the sun rule, the J-log moment sun rule in this form. Then we can sum over all of the weight contribution for all of millions of excitations here. And then we compare the ratio between them. And for S minus plus, we found that indeed the two pair Poisson-Poisson excitations can saturate the sun rule very well, 90 or 95%. So, but for S plus minus, we observe that the excitation of the real excitations actually is very bad if we go closer to the J-log magnetization limit, and only dominant when the magnetization is very large. And indeed, in this region, the single two-string and single three-string plays an important role to understand the dynamic spectrum of the system. And actually, I didn't draw the even law magnetization. So you will see that a single string will also become more and more dominant. But it will become more and more complicated, the single three strand, the deformed single strip is not our story today. So now we also compare the first frequency moment. Now what is the first frequency moment? First frequency moment is a definition in this form. And basically you multiply the DSF by frequency and integrate over the full range of frequency from minus infinity to plus infinity. And then luckily for this model, we can exactly determine it. And the experimentalists will be happy about this. Why? Because you can compare it at each fixed momentum. That will be really nice. So basically, we can compare at each momentum and see what happens about the sun ratio for the first frequency moment. So we can see that overall, after we include the string contribution, no matter at which meditation, overall the comparison, the sun ratio is very good, saturated to 90%, over 90%. Even at the large magnetization, it's even the string state also contributes significantly. Although for the zero moment sun ratio, it less important. That's because the string state is a high energy excitation. So its contribution will be augmented by this first frequency moment sun rule. So it's not hard to imagine the string state is very dominant for this first frequency sun rule. For first frequency sun rule. However, there's still a very interesting thing here. When the meditation is very small, there's something missing here at zero momentum. And we try very hard to figure out what it is. Unfortunately, we fail. So apparently, at zero momentum, there's still about 50% physics is missing. So that will be a very interesting new type of quasi-particle excitation, which is only purely dominant, the zero moment physics. So, and then here comes to our theoretical prediction. So at each momentum, as I say, at each momentum, we can draw the line. We can draw a line along the energy direction. And then we can draw the DSF with respect to energy. And then at each momentum, we can pick up the peak potential. And then we can draw the peak potential with respect to the tuning of the field and see how the peak potential evolve. And then we give our predictions of those lines corresponding to different kinds of excitations. This is a single three string at Q equal to power of 2. This is single. Please don't take photo of this as it's required by experimentalists. So here is a single two string corresponding to Q equal to power of 2. So this is a single two string corresponding to Q equal to pi. And this is the real excitations of either pairs of Poisson excitations or either pairs of Poisson or anti-Poisson excitations. Very luckily, all of these excitations are confirmed by experiments with very high accuracy. So a collaboration paper was submitted to Science last month. No, this is a theoretical prediction, but the experimental data agree with this very well. So I cannot show you the data, yeah. So still is in this region. So basically, under this brute force tool on this XZ model, we figure out very interesting dominant excitations, which is string excitations. And the string excitation can be very stable. And apparently, there are many new features it's worth to explore. Like, what is the entanglement structure of the string excitations, right? And what kind of new features we can draw out from the string excitations? Since they are stable, actually, in experiment, they can use a fast laser, very fast laser, maybe FM laser or maybe AM laser. They can excite it and explore the physical information during very short time excitation, maybe millisecond or but milliseconds still is already long enough for them to measure those kinds of the physical information of string excitations. And that is the next goal. The next goal for the experimentalists. So here's the conclusion for this part. We calculated the transverse DSF in the XZ model. We found the dominant string excitations in the gapless region well beyond the conventional Latin liquid paradigm or Poisson spin-on picture. We demonstrated good agreement with sun rule, laying down a concrete support for the identification of the excitations in the XZ model. We proposed the proper spin dynamics experiments to probe the novel string excitations. So, any question for this story?
Can you give us a physical picture about string excitation?
Actually, it's better to start from the magnetron picture. Spin-on picture, I don't know how to answer that, but magnetron is easier.
For string.
Yeah. Basically, string is just a bound state of pairs of magnetron or multi-magnetrons. Like if you flip down spin, right? If you down spin, and some down spin move together, and that's a string.
Without changing the
x. Without changing the x, yeah. Without changing the x. Because we see here, The length, the view function of the string part will be the length, the typical length of the view function will be dominated by this imaginary part. So basically the length of the view function of this bound state almost is fixed. And they move together here. Yeah.
So when the maximization is say half.
Okay, my sense half.
Half of the maximum.
Okay.
Fully polarized.
Okay, fully.
Half of the spin. Half of the spin out.
Yeah, and then you need to flip n over four spin, right?
Okay.
And you need to do one over four spin. And then among n over four spins, there are various kinds of excitations. It could be real states, it could be string states, it could be it could be very, very, very complicated. But the dominancy for the spin creation is just turns out just the most low energy of the string state, a single two or single three.
So every n over four spins are
moving. No, actually, if this n over four spins form into a string state, then they move together. However, it could be some of them is just the renormalized magnon. They move together, and they move independently. It could be some of them form into bound state. They move independently. So because every rapidity here is a good quantum number, it's conserved, it's renormalized, it's momentum, right? There's no dissipation here, there's no other environment here. It's an isolated Hamiltonian. You solve this one.
When you say one string state, that's the state where all those...
No, not all those, just part of it. Part of the string with a lot of free magnons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it looks like a dragon. It's swaying in the sea of magnon. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then the length of the...
The length is fixed. It's fixed by the scale length is fixed by this one. By the imaginary part. Imaginary part of reality. And this imaginary part of reality is uniquely determined by the anisotropy. We don't need to know any other information. This is a string ansatz. Yeah.
So there's only one string and all others are...
It could be one string, it could be two strings, it could be pairs of strings. It depends on how much energy you put in and how large the weight it is. If the weight is very small, then it's impossible to be observed, right? If the weight, the form factor is very large, then you will be very clearly observed here. This corresponds to very large weight. The darker it is, the larger weight it is.
That dark one is so
yeah, we're corresponding to a larger weight, very larger
string,
weight.
One string state?
This band corresponding to a single two, one single two string. One single two string with a number of free magnon. Yeah. It's still a collective excitation. But from the picture of the icing limit, somehow it's oversimplified. You know, because now it's in the middle of somewhere, then actually all the spin actually come into play. It's the Hamiltonian XZ model. It's not the IC model again.
So what determines the width in the, so at a given momentum, you have some finite width in the...
Oh, finite width of the band.
Yeah, yeah. What determines that?
It depends on the energy dispersion of the corresponding single two string states. Yeah.
Well, this is for two strings.
Yeah, single. This band is for single two string. This band is for single three string. Single three string. That single three string means that there's only one string with three magnons combined together, and the other are free magnons, and then they move inside the system.
The darkest one is single two string.
And this band corresponds to a single two string excitation. That means there's one string with a pair of bonded magnons, and all other magnons are free to move.
And that width is
the width of dispersion, from dispersion. They have their own dispersion. Dispersion. Yeah.
You mean, but you said
dispersion.
These two magnons are bound with the string.
The two magnons form into a bound string, but you have an infinite number of other magnons, right? Because you flip n over four spin, right? You flip n over four spin, and then n over four is very large, and then two of them becomes a two string, and all of that over just a magnon. The renormalized magnon is no boson, and not from me either.
Yeah.
but they freely move, they can freely move inside the system because the rapidity, every rapidity here can correctly describe, it's a faithful description of the velocity of the particle. Yeah. Because in the relativity theory, rapidity is just the velocity of particle.
And then what is the size of the string at a given issue?
Say, size of string. Size of string is determined by the imaginary part of this one. Oh, sorry, I didn't. It's not that straightforward. The this size is relevant to the anisotropy by a special function.
It's
also
10 or
I don't know. I don't know the number now. Yeah, I didn't prepare that. Sorry. Yeah, but it's exponentially decay. It's exponentially decay. The wheel function of the string. It's the typical length scale actually. It's exponential decay actually. So it's short range actually. It's not long. The wheel function. The expand of the wheel function is not. It's not large. It's just. It's highly localized, I think.
The string is short? Or?
Yeah, the string is short, but they can free move. The string is short, yeah, right?
String is short.
Yeah, string is short, yeah.
It's order of one, is it?
Pardon?
It's order of one?
I don't know, order of one. Maybe order of 10, maybe order of 5, I don't know. Because now, yeah, it may be just a field size distance, I don't know. I cannot give you the answer right now. I need to check the value. Yeah, but it's a bound. It's localized, I think. But how localized it is, I don't have the value now. Yeah.
And I was wondering whether that has to do with the fluctuation in the length.
Oh, you mean dispersion, right?
Hmm?
You mean the dispersion or
The width.
The width of the band, right?
Yeah. Whether that has to do with fluctuation.
Yeah, the width of the band. Yeah.
Fluctuation of the length.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. The width of band here is also not so straightforward. Actually, the band itself actually is wider than the band plot here. But many of them here actually is negligible. Here they only show that the most dominancy for the two spin dynamic creation function. So it's a real width of a band. Is larger, a few times larger than the width I show here. Because not every particle in this band is able to be observed by Spearman. Just the one which has the most significant weight can give you observable features, like the darkest one here.
And is there a way to understand that Q dependence of that energy of one thing, the dark band?
Yeah, if we look at this DSF, we are not sure. But if we look at the band, just dispersion, we have the information. We have the information. But as I say, have that information still is not that helpful because it cannot tell you the dynamic information in real experiment. So if there's no more question, and then here's an outlook of my possible outlook. Yeah, there are some more proposals in my resume. But here, it will be very interesting if we can give a full picture. We can give a full picture about the fundamental dynamics of the FIFO model. Then we can compare with numerous experiments, actually. And it's possible. It requires new techniques. It's not just the technique I use. Although the technique I use already very involved, maybe 600 to 800 page calculation. But for the accuracy itself, as I say, what is the entanglement structure? We don't know. It's very hard to study, actually. But it will be very interesting because from the quantum computer sense, from quantum information sense, right, it's high energy, it's stable, and then the temperature effect will be less significant. So it's worth to explore the entanglement structure if there's a way. And also, a full picture about the dynamic spectra along the full line of data to see how those dominant stations evolve with respect to data and age will also be very interesting, because as Sanji mentioned just now, at the access point, every citation is real. There's no string citations. And how those citations transformed into all of these real citations, then actually it's also very interesting, actually. I believe we will have also broad experimental impacts. Okay, thanks for your time and patience. So, any more questions?
Okay. I have a very quick question. So, do you go through the slide showing the diagram of the speed access chain? Right. So, you are working at the region where the zero temperature is gapped. Right?
Yeah, I work in this region.
The red line?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is this. Suppose you work at zero temperature and you have a finite delta.
Okay.
And you gradually go from the gap phase region to the
gas
region.
Okay.
As you approach the Heisenberg limit.
Okay.
So presumably all these, there's a power of gap exceptions. And each one has its own mass.
Okay, so you ask the question, what is the excitation nature for this small line here?
Right.
They're all spinning.
So they're all gaps.
No matter. Yeah, they're all gaps. Yeah.
So do you know,
no matter as mass class, all of them are spinning.
Is there something like a universal ratio between the mass between the ratio of the mass between these these gap excitations?
I don't think there's a certain universal feature. Because universal usually means that low energy nearly covers.
Right.
So,
still remain
close to Heisenberg limit. Yeah, very close to here. If it's very close to here, it didn't touch here. It's still gap, but I don't know. I don't know the answer here. Sorry.
Yeah, I was basically asking if there's something similar to this EA story in this.
Okay, that's a very cool question. Yeah, actually, I have another collaboration with some of this on the EA story not for this model, but a similar model, but. But for this model, it's not yet. It's not yet. But for the machine itself,
would there be something similar?
Because for the EA, it's impossible. Because for the EA, you need a transport field. You need a transport field. Here you are working in icing limit, right? Beta larger than one. You can say this train is icing-like, but unfortunately, this is a longitudinal field. You need a transport field to really generate EA. If there's no transport field here, it's impossible to get EA.
I'm not asking about exactly the BA. I'm asking whether
there's
something similar.
No, nothing like it.
So there's nothing like
nothing like it between
these masses.
Yeah, no. But interesting is that in the material study, the material itself can internally induce a transport field. But like internally induce a longitudinal field, then I can apply a transport field study. And then sure, it's still an accuracy model. However, when the transport field is very, very large, you will find out the physics will become kind of like a transport field icing-like. And because the internal field inside the material is very small, indeed, they observe some features similar as here. But that's another story, not included here. That's another collaboration. So this is a very tough project. It's really tough, yeah. It continues our, we continuously make thousands of hours on this project. For reading through all these brilliant papers from Steven Yang, Fadi Yifu, Dreamfeld, Mallet, Kitana, that's really tough. But finally, the result is exciting. That's one part. That's just one emotional comment. Yeah, it hurts my hands actually a little bit. Really, yeah, true. Yeah, you don't sleep hours, days, weeks, then it's really, really hurt my hands.
Okay, any further questions? All right, then let's thank Chanda again.
Thank you. Awesome, thank you.